and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is After Oil from the Purdue University College of Engineering. I'm Barbara Bogave.
Each hour of the day, our oil-thirsty nation demands over 10 million gallons of petroleum products.
These were the good old days.
While the tanker is loading in California, a barge filled with home fuel oil has just left a refinery in Louisiana.
When oil was something we controlled, when it fueled our demand and not much else.
More than any other country in the world, America is a nation on wheels.
When we look at everything that shaped America over the years, immigration, slavery, westward expansion, it's fair to say that for the last 100-some years, America has been shaped more than anything by cheap oil. Today, it's hard to see how we could exist without it. Cheap oil sustains our economy. It runs our lifestyle. It runs our foreign policy. In fact, you could say,
America is addicted to oil.
See the USA in your Chevrolet. America is asking you to call.
These young adults, shopping with the same determination that led them to the suburbs in the first place, are the goingest part of a nation on wheels, living by the automobile.
U.S. gasoline consumption has increased by 60%, and U.S. oil imports have increased by more than 100%.
Already today, she's used some 87 petroleum products, including the plastic bacon wrapper and the wax of the milk carton. She'll top 100 before the day is over.
There was a time, of course, when this wasn't a big deal. Nothing stood in the way of America feeding this addiction to cheap oil. But now, there's a dark cloud. There are plenty of signs that the party is over. It's time for the hangover to begin.
People simply don't realize the scale of the problem, the length of time, and the amount of money involved.
Roger Bezdek runs an economic research firm called Management Information Services. A while back, he wrote a report for the U.S. Department of Energy. The subject is what's commonly called peak oil. That's the day when the world supply of oil peaks and then begins to decline.
We're talking about economic costs that could make the problems of the 1970s look almost trivial by comparison.
Prices here can be found a tenth of a penny away from $4 a gallon.
It's not that oil is going to run out. It's just that up to now, the oil's been easy. High-quality crude that we could find in Pennsylvania or Texas. After the peak, the rest of the oil will be hard. Hard to refine. In places where they don't like us, or places that we have a heck of a time getting to. Remember after the hurricanes in the Gulf when gas prices jumped to near $3.50 a gallon? The peak oil people say, those were the good old days.
We need to get ready for way, way higher prices, and we're going to pay way higher prices for way less quality oil.
Matt Simmons runs an international energy investment banking firm.
In my adult lifetime, we had two very brief periods of time when we had shortages of oil, and within 90 days, the price went up threefold.
Do the math. It adds up to businesses shuttered, homes that can't be heated or cooled, empty highways, whole suburbs left for dead.
98% of our transportation energy comes from oil. So if we have a scarcity of transportation, then just look around at how many things we use that come from very long distances and say that life ends.
It seems no other people in the world want so much just to get going when they have a little time. Maybe it's just that no other people can get going so easily.
Now, to be clear, not everyone thinks this will happen, or that if it does, it'll happen tomorrow. Joan Ogden is with the Institute of Transportation Studies at the University of California, Davis.
How soon is this going to happen? I mean, there are different points of view on this.
And there are plenty. Take Mike Ramage, a retired executive with ExxonMobil Research and Engineering. He thinks it's not happening at all.
I don't believe that crisis will happen.
We have almost no reliable data of any of the significant producing oil fields of how much they're now producing. We just have some estimates of how much each country produces. So we're really basically, you know, wrapped in an enigma of mystery about this whole future oil supply.
Both Simmons and Roger Bezdek say, if you know where to look, there's plenty of evidence to suggest the peak is coming and that the effects will be much different from the energy crisis of the 1970s. According to Dr. Jay Gore, director of Purdue University's Energy Center, this is inevitable.
The number of people on the Earth is continuing to grow, and there are predictions that the planet could reach 10 billion people.
What else could happen in a world where the population gets that big? and where many of those people have an expectation of living a lifestyle like ours.
We start to make a list of grand challenges that such a world would face, and every time you make that type of a list, you come up with energy at the top of that list.
Simmons and Bezdek say the problem is this. Since the 1980s, new oil discoveries just haven't kept up. Think about everything else in your life that runs on gasoline. Trash collection, snow removal, next day package delivery.
Both the military and civilian officials are very concerned with both the price volatility, and eventually availability of jet fuel.
And there's more.
Petroleum derivatives kill insects and plant diseases, speed the ripening of fruit, and preserve it on the way to market.
No more of that Argentinian asparagus you like to buy at Whole Foods in January. Michael Pollan is the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, about our industrial agricultural system.
This whole system adds more and more fossil fuel down the line. To process the food, to create that high fructose corn syrup, lots of oil. To ship all that food, it's lots more oil. And you end up with a situation where about a fifth of our fossil fuel use is going to feed ourselves.
This is a riot in Malaysia that broke out last May when people gathered to protest the high cost of gasoline. Is this what we face? Purdue's Jay Gore says, not necessarily.
Given that it is a very important problem, given that it is a problem to which we don't know the solution, and given that our future depends on it, those three things make it a grand challenge problem that the world should invest in. And so I am infinitely optimistic that we will find a solution.
We do have the technology, or at least there's every reason to think we will. Ernest Moniz is a professor of physics and engineering systems at MIT.
Frankly, our strength lies in technology. And so the issue in going to alternative energy sources, in general, is about capturing the results of new science and new technology.
And we have more than a handful of tools to get us there. As Ernie Moniz says,
there will not be one silver bullet. We are going to need a multiplicity of alternative technologies to meet our demand, security, and environmental concerns.
And these would include things like biofuels.
The United States has massive, massive reserves of coal.
Coal to liquids, oil shale, enhanced oil recovery, heavy oil, biomass.
Conservation of energy is a very important solution as well.
Renewables, advanced nuclear power, capturing carbon dioxide and sequestering it underground.
Wind and photovoltaic panels and, you know, geothermal, the energy of the earth.
It also would include hydrogen.
Conventional oil, non-conventional oil, coal, nuclear.
There's not a lot of thinking at this point about which is the best idea. In fact, a lot of experts say there is no best. As Purdue's Jay Gore says,
none of us know the right answer.
And MIT's Ernie Moniz points out, that's partly because it's so tough to compete with oil.
Fossil fuels have an enormous energy density and are available at reasonably low cost. So this is a bar we have to realize is there and is fairly high.
So no one technology wins. Instead, scientists and engineers are looking for ways to marshal everything at our disposal, starting with the science we have and engineering improvements where we can. The last few times we all went looking for a solution to our dependence on fossil fuels, we found nuclear power, then solar, geothermal, and wind. They're still there, of course, and ready for deployment. Now, though, we're going to take a look at the developments that look like the future these days. We start with an easy one.
Here we are in the Toyota Motor Manufacturing Plant in Princeton, Indiana.
Nathan Bruins walks through an auto manufacturing plant that he helped engineer. Since it opened, he's helped re-engineer it to make sure it saves energy.
We've replaced our 400-watt metal halide high bay fixtures with fluorescent six-tube T8 lamps. And over the past couple of years, we've changed out almost 2,000 of these fixtures, so that's quite a reduction right there.
If you grew up during the Great Depression or the energy crisis in the 70s like I did, your parents probably were all over you to turn off the lights when you left a room, obviously because it saved money. Well, what worked in your parents' house works in a factory too, or an office building. Reinhard Rademacher runs the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Energy Engineering. He says the cost of an energy-efficient building, that's the mortgage plus utilities, is exactly the same as a conventional building.
The energy consumption can be reduced by 50% at the same monthly cost.
And the changes don't necessarily have to be all that drastic.
Energy-efficient lighting, double-pane or triple-pane windows, insulation, minimizing infiltration of air into the building, and things of this nature are pretty much the low-hanging fruit.
During ideal temperatures, like then we'll bring in 100% outside air and not use our chilled water system to cool that air.
Making changes like these not only puts more money in a building owner's pocket, when you consider the looming shadow of peak oil, making these changes is also doing the world a favor. As Rademacher puts it,
pushing off the day of doom. When we consider that alternative energy right now contributes about a few percent of the total energy consumption, if our total energy consumption were cut in half, the contribution of renewables would already be doubled as what it is right now.
Now we're on top of the Toyota plant on the roof. Right now it's a beautiful day, and I wish I had my golf clubs, but...
The Indiana Toyota plant used to have a black roof. Last time they decided to paint it, Nathan Bruin's team did some tests. They used two different aluminum coatings and then a coat of white paint. They found that on a sunny day,
the roof would have been close to 170 degrees, very hot. The aluminum coatings were about 140 degrees, whereas the white coating, it was just ambient temperature.
This simple change reduced Toyota's cooling load so much, they're able to completely turn off one of their 2,100-ton chillers during the daytime. The Sierra Club's Dave Hamilton says, you take that kind of savings and think of the impact nationwide.
We can take care of the next 300 power plants we need in this country by making the way we use electricity more efficient. Every time you're using a more efficient light bulb, you're taking that out of demand and putting it back in supply, just as if you dug a bunch of coal up and burned it.
The changes at the Toyota plant were made voluntarily, but a lot of the energy efficiency changes we see around us today are involuntary, especially in homes. They're the result of federal rules and laws.
I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. From now on, every new addition to our demand for energy will be met from our own production and our own conservation.
Congress mandated energy efficiency in the late 70s. As a consequence, Reinhard Rademacher says,
household refrigerators, for example, cost the same as it did two or three decades ago, but have much lower energy consumption.
That's because the new laws forced engineers at appliance companies to build to a different standard.
A completely separate food freezer that holds 84 pounds of frozen foods.
It wasn't just about styling and maximizing storage anymore. Instead, the motivation became energy efficiency. As a result,
heat exchangers got better, compressors got better, reliability was improved along the way.
In refrigerators, that meant changing from fiberglass insulation to blown foam insulation in the walls. Increasing wall thickness and figuring out only the places where they had to do it so you could maintain the volume of the refrigerator. Add all that to more efficient air conditioners, more efficient furnaces, and overall, much more efficient homes.
Now we're standing at the utilities building next to the thermal storage tank.
Odd thing about this Toyota plant, for all the energy saving they do with thermal storage tanks and fluorescent light bulbs, this is also the place where they make the Toyota Tundra and the Sequoia, two of the vehicles in the Toyota fleet with the worst gas mileage. Which brings us to an important question. How do we engineer cars to become more efficient? Fuel economy in the United States has been essentially flat since the mid-80s. But as UC Davis's Joan Ogden says,
there are technologies out there that could make another big jump in fuel economy.
Technologies, she says, and the technological know-how.
All during this time, car engines have actually been getting more efficient. Well, so why haven't the cars been getting more efficient? Well, those efficiency improvements have gone into making the cars faster time from 0 to 60.
GMC. Engineered to the highest standard, professional grade.
Just like the refrigerator engineers who focused on storage space until they were forced to focus on energy savings. Ogden says we could have cars that are 20 or 30% more fuel efficient if car companies took advantage of those engine improvements to improve fuel economy.
If we were willing to back off on the fast performance a little bit and on the weight a little bit, we could improve fuel economy quite markedly.
She says it's time for Congress to do to cars what it did for appliances 30 years ago. More on that idea later in the show, along with a focus on new fuels that might free us from oil. When we come back, this is After Oil from the Purdue University College of Engineering. I'm Barbara Bogave, and we'll be back after a break. This is After Oil from the Purdue University College of Engineering. I'm Barbara Bogave. We're looking at the tools that might help us break free of our dependence on oil. We started with the least labor-intensive solution.
Turning off lights.
And we turn now to maybe the most labor-intensive.
This equipment that's in front of us is firstly is a 20,000 horsepower motor.
We're midway between Bismarck and Minot, North Dakota. It's just south of the Canadian border and right in the middle of nowhere. Outside, it's about 40 below zero as Fred Stern walks us through the Dakota Gasification Company's Great Plains Synfuels plant.
All the piping you see attached to this compressor is used to take the gas from one stage of compression off to a heat exchanger for cooling.
The Great Plains plant is involved in coal gasification. And as those words pass my lips, I imagine the sound of thousands of radios turning off all over America. To paraphrase Elliot Gould in Animal House, remember the scene where he's the English professor talking about Milton? I find coal gasification probably as boring as you find coal gasification.
Mrs. Milton found him boring, too. He's a little bit long-winded. He doesn't translate very well into our generation, and his jokes are terrible.
But that does not relieve you from your responsibility for this material. I'm waiting for reports from some of you.
And now, coal gasification.
Well, basically what we have is that the coal enters the top of the building on a series of belts.
While America may be running out of our own supplies of oil, we still have plenty of coal. Every day, thousands of pounds of lignite pour into the Dakota gasification plant, where it's turned into natural gas. Still with me? Okay, then join us in the coal lock.
The coal lock is a vessel that can be pressurized and depressurized, and it then allows coal to fall from the lock into what we call a gasifier.
Inside the gasifier, the coal is injected with steam and oxygen. That burns the coal and creates methane, carbon monoxide, sulfur compounds, and a handful of other gases.
We remove all the various sulfur compounds. After that has taken place, we now have a gas that is primarily methane, carbon monoxide, and hydrogen.
They put that gas together with a catalyst that makes the hydrogen and carbon monoxide combine to form more methane. And then the whole thing goes off to a pipeline and on to Chicago and Dubuque.
Today, we have the capability of producing nearly 170 million standard cubic feet per day of product gas.
Gasification's been around a long time. It's how Germany powered its tanks in the Second World War. The popularity of gasification waxes and wanes, depending on the cost of natural gas, and I am talking about its popularity as a fuel. Its popularity as a topic of conversation is pretty much fixed. It goes back and forth as a fuel because the plants are so darn expensive to build and maintain. And these days, there's another problem. Gasification plants give off massive amounts of CO2. And it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to create alternative energy that contributes to global warming. But Dakota Gasification has an ingenious solution to this problem. At the Dakota Coal Gasification Plant, they don't give off any CO2. They use a process that strips out the CO2. Then they pressurize it with this giant compressor you're listening to. They stick it into a pipeline, It heads north.
And travels some 205 miles until it reaches the Weyburn and Midale oil fields in southern Saskatchewan, Canada.
The Canadians use the carbon dioxide for oil recovery. They pump it into old, depleted oil fields to make more oil come out. And once it's underground, scientists say that CO2 stays underground pretty much forever. This is actually another new technology that's helping in the search for alternative energy. It's called CO2 capture and sequestration. Basically, you take carbon dioxide, capture it before it gets in the air, and then you bury it underground. It's an idea that on the surface it sounds so silly, but at the same time it's so obvious. It's almost like something you'd hear a 9-year-old suggest for a class project.
Well, carbon dioxide causes global warming. I think you could like kind of fill bags with it and bury them. That would be cool.
Yeah, it sounds goofy. And even 7 or 8 years ago, it was considered goofy. But not today.
If we look at geological storage of CO2, if we sort of rewind the tape to, you know, 1998, 2000, it was still very much a conceptual idea.
Sally Benson is a professor in the Energy Resources Engineering Department at Stanford University.
Since that time, there has been a tremendous amount of interest in CO2 capture and storage.
There are two types of places that scientists are eyeing as the best ones to put CO2. One is old oil and gas reservoirs.
Those are particularly suitable sites because just by virtue of having trapped gas or oil for millions of years, we know that there's a good seal.
The second is something called saline formations, which is just a fancy name for a limestone pit, where the pores in the rock are filled with water. Dr. Benson says these are popular because you can pretty much find them anywhere.
So if you have a power plant, you're much more likely to be close to a saline formation than you would be to an oil or gas reservoir.
As for how you do this, again, it's so simple a 9-year-old might have thought of it.
You would drill a well.
You take a drill bit, you dig into the earth, then you install metal casings that are cemented in to create a good seal between the casing and the natural rock. You poke holes in the bottom of the casing and then pump in the CO2.
The first thing that happens is CO2 begins to dissolve. In some cases, there are projections that after 1,000 years or so, all of the CO2 would have been dissolved. So basically, the CO2 becomes part of the rock itself.
The Department of Energy is testing the process now. Benson says it'll become part of our arsenal soon.
Someday you're going to be using this in your cars. Fuel from agricultural waste.
If coal seems heavy and dirty, our next alternative energy source is the one touted by its supporters as the most clean and natural.
If all the E85 capable vehicles on the road today, along with those that GM, Ford, and Daimler Chrysler have already committed to produce over the next 10 years, if they were to run on E85, we could displace 22 billion gallons of gasoline annually.
That's the CEO of General Motors, Rick Wagner, testifying to a House subcommittee in March. He's talking about ethanol. Detroit loves ethanol. The E85 that Wagner mentioned is a type of fuel that's 85% ethanol and 15% gasoline. Ethanol is really just alcohol, and using it to fuel a car is not a new idea.
In Detroit, a man named Henry Ford, who had left the farm and come to the city to tinker with machinery, was making what he called a quadricycle.
It was actually a popular fuel back when Henry Ford was building cars one at a time. Today, 2.5% of gasoline is mixed with it. Ethanol's promoters say this helps cut our dependence on foreign oil and fights global warming. But there's a problem. Here's an oil man to tell you what it is.
Right now, most of our ethanol is made from corn.
This renewable energy source meets the needs of automobile manufacturers.
Problem is, things aren't as simple as this promotional movie by the Midwest grain processors would suggest. First of all, Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, points out,
every bushel of corn takes somewhere between a quarter and a third of a gallon of gasoline equivalent to grow.
And there's another problem with corn ethanol.
The problem is we got a lot of hog growers who are beginning to feel the pinch as a result of high corn prices. And so the question then is, how do you achieve your goal of less dependence on oil without breaking your farmers?
Here's how.
This is what it's called, our small-scale fermentation area.
Mike Arbage is a vice president at Genencor, a company that makes enzymes for industry. Enzymes are chemicals that break things up. Genencor does a lot of work with detergent companies, for example, figuring out new ways to get grass stains off your kids' Levi's. But lately, they've invested in a new area, making cellulosic ethanol. That's ethanol from something other than corn. In this case, grass and garbage. Jack Huttner runs Genencor's biorefinery business.
Cellulosic ethanol is being able to go beyond food crops like corn and wheat to waste streams like corn stover or wheat straw or wood chips.
Okay, what we're looking at here is a bank of over 50 20-liter fermenters.
The process of making ethanol from crop garbage is no different from making ethanol from corn. Enzymes break down plants into simple sugars, and then the sugars are fermented in yeast to make ethanol. The problem, though, is that corn breaks down a lot more efficiently than stalks and grass. So most of the work being done to bring cellulosic ethanol to market is around that, making it break down better. Genencor's scientists work to bioengineer enzymes that are better at chewing up the plants. At the same time,
so here we are in one of the research and teaching greenhouses at Harvard University. It's located on top of the biological laboratories.
Other scientists are working to grow plants that just break down on their own. Michelle Holbrook is a professor of forestry at Harvard. She walks through the greenhouse on top of the Harvard Biology Lab and stops in front of some grasses that she says
are good candidates for manipulating and growing for bioenergy crops.
Holbrook is working with molecular biologists and agronomists at Purdue to grow the perfect ethanol grass. It's not easy. Remember, the way ethanol happens is plants are broken down and the material that's left over is fermented. The problem is this. You can engineer a plant with a cell wall that breaks down easily when it's dead, but if you do, that plant won't be able to suck up any water when it's alive. So a plant with a strong stem, it gets water, but you can't ferment it. A plant with a weak stem, you could ferment it if it would just live long enough, but it can't.
That's where our research comes in.
Holbrook and her team are working to create grass that's strong enough to stand up, but weak enough to break down.
What you see here is a small-scale reactor. This is a 20-liter reactor.
Back at Genencor, the search goes on for more effective enzymes. From a business standpoint, the company is feeling like this cellulosic ethanol thing might be a large piece of the future.
Well, this is the biggest thing since radio, and I'm letting you in on the ground floor.
They've taken a matching grant from the state of New York and put up $20 million of their own money to build a cellulosic ethanol plant in Rochester.
Rochester? Well, why Rochester?
Well, why not? Can you think of anything better?
If you were to say petroleum costs $50 a barrel, which is where we are today, and moving upward, ethanol becomes a very reasonable substitute.
When you think about it, ethanol's really only a half step. If we're going to become energy independent, shouldn't there be a way to drive without using gasoline at all?
The high-series drive powertrain can deliver the equivalent of 41 miles per gallon. Of course, there aren't any gallons because there's no gasoline. Ah, the beauty of it all. Ford says
the underhood of this vehicle, which is the Ford Edge, is fundamentally empty.
This is the vehicle that Ford, at least, is hoping will get us there.
So first of all, the vehicle that we're standing next to is a running prototype.
Mujib Ijaz is a vehicle engineering manager at Ford. He's at the auto show in Washington, D.C., showing off what he calls a hybrid hybrid, an SUV that runs on electricity and hydrogen.
And the vehicle runs in a battery electric mode only for the first 25 miles.
The car runs on a battery powered by lithium ion, like the battery in your laptop. Only this one's about the size of one of those coolers you take to the beach. Up near the front rearview mirror, there's a socket like you'd find on an electric lawnmower. If you charge it overnight and then you charge it at work, it'll take you 50 miles. Ijaz says most Americans drive 30 miles a day round trip.
Customers do want them, but they don't want to pay for them. If I look at that situation, I have to come to the conclusion that the vehicle has to have a greater customer benefit than simply being an environmental solution.
Ford is hoping that benefit will be the money you save at the gas pump. An SUV this size gets around 19 miles a gallon. If gas is $3, that's $190 a month. If you commute in the electric SUV, it's $46 a month. So are you excited? Want to run out and buy one? More on that later. Ford's not the only company with a plug-in concept.
Plug-in car. So this car is a hybrid vehicle. It'll run a little bit on battery and a lot on gas.
This is a modified Toyota Prius being demonstrated at the White House. It's been converted to a plug-in car. And if you still want a plug-in, but you're concerned that these cars are ugly, and by the way, you're on the right track there, you can try this instead.
This is the Tesla Roadster, a 100% digital electric car under development.
The Tesla looks like any other super expensive sports car. Only when you start it up, there's no roar like a Ferrari. Instead, you hear nothing.
It's literally 100% electric. That means
at this stage, the auto companies seem to be looking at electric batteries as a halfway measure, as a way to give you a little freedom, but mostly to get you back and forth to a filling station. So let's take a look at, once you get to the filling station, what you might be putting in your tank.
This is Shell Hydrogen's Benning Road Visitor Center and Gasoline Hydrogen Station. It's the first of its kind in North America.
One thing you could fill it up with is hydrogen. Believe it or not, there are actually hydrogen gas stations open around the country. Most are in California. This one, run by Shell, is in Washington, D.C.
Well, this station, we have a partnership with General Motors. And
a number of companies are working on hydrogen cars. You heard about Ford's. GM's CEO told Congress that his company is building 100 of them to run in D.C., California, and New York. Now, the way a hydrogen car works, it's a little complicated. So I'm going to use a tried-and-true public radio method for explaining something complex.
Hi, I'm Jad.
And I'm Robert.
So, Bob, how does a hydrogen car work?
Well, I wanted to know that, too.
Me too.
Me too. And so I asked someone.
My name is Joan Ogden.
Joan Ogden. She says a hydrogen car is fueled by...
true love.
It's what?
It's really, in some ways, a matter of true love.
True love?
A matter of true love.
That's right. A hydrogen car is fueled by love. See, there's hydrogen and oxygen on opposite sides of an electrolyte membrane.
These things want to get together so much.
But the hydrogen can't go through the membrane. Well, the proton of the hydrogen can go through the membrane, but not the electron.
So what does the electron do? You make an external circuit, you put your motor on that.
The electron runs the circuit. It runs the car. And then you let it through the membrane, and you're left with water and heat. Got it? Okay, kill the cheesy music. A great thing about hydrogen, you can make it out of pretty much anything.
So whether you have a natural gas or you have a coal or you have a solar energy or nuclear, you can always get hydrogen.
Rakesh Agrawal is a professor of chemical engineering at Purdue.
Hydrogen, in some sense, is like electricity, right?
Today, he says, we make it in large amounts, large enough to fuel whole fleets of cars and trucks. And that's nice, but that hydrogen station in Washington...
this is our gaseous hydrogen dispenser. And
they only have one in the whole city. A big question is, how do you get hydrogen to as many places as there are gasoline stations today? Mike Ramage, the retired ExxonMobil engineer, says there are a few options. It could be, like they do here, fleets of trucks that ship the hydrogen, the same way we ship gasoline today.
It could mean pipelines. It could also mean short-term building small hydrogen generation units at filling stations.
We're out on the plant floor, and you can see this is one of our small 2,000 cubic feet an hour hydrogen plants being put together.
Frank Lomax is one step ahead of you. He runs a company called H2Gen in Alexandria, Virginia. Their main product is a reactor that takes natural gas, combines it with steam, and makes another gas that has hydrogen in it. The machine purifies the gas.
And then send the hydrogen to the customer.
With the H2Gen reactor, you don't need to build any new pipelines to get the hydrogen to the filling station.
Basically, you'd take the pipe that's bringing the natural gas for them to heat the service station, and you would just branch a line off and feed this.
Today, H2Gen sells its generators to companies that need hydrogen to make windshields or hydrogenated vegetable oil. But their ultimate aim is to fuel cars.
Well, this is the HDM 10,000, and it looks a lot bigger than the smaller plant, but the small plant is good for about 20 cars a day or 3 buses. This plant is 5 times more.
The H2Gen process does give off some CO2, But Mike Ramage points out that when you compare the CO2 involved in hydrogen cars to what we're pumping out today, it's no contest.
If you turn around and told the world today that if you could drive all the fuel cell vehicles with natural gas-derived hydrogen, and your CO2 emissions would be cut by two-thirds, you think they'd all say yes? Yes, they would.
So, there's our suite of alternative energy solutions, just in time to stave off the oil peak, if it comes. Are you hopeful yet? Or are you asking, okay, this is all great, but why can't I use any of it today? We'll explain that when we come back. This is After Oil from the Purdue University College of Engineering. I'm Barbara Bogave. This is After Oil from the Purdue University College of Engineering. I'm Barbara Bogave. If we believe predictions we've heard in this program, then it's reasonable to say that every time we drive, we're being chased by the specter of peak oil and the question of what do we do from now until the oil runs out. We've just heard about six different ideas, but you have to wonder. Sure, they sound great, but are they real or are they hype? And regardless, with a crisis looming, how long will it take to put these ideas in place? Purdue University's Jay Gore says,
the technological answer is not a short-term answer. We are going to go from point A to point B, whether we go on a very smooth road or we have a roller coaster ride is the only uncertainty.
He's confident, but the track record is not that great.
While nuclear power in locomotives, submarines, and even very large airplanes may all but revolutionize future transportation on land, sea, and air.
If you go back to the 1950s, we were told by proponents that nuclear power would be too cheap to meter with just a little bit of government support.
Jerry Taylor is director of natural resource studies at the Cato Institute.
It's still about the most expensive source of electricity on the power grid if you look at not only operating but capital costs. We were told in the 50s and 60s and 70s as well that getting oil out of coal would be the next great thing. And despite tens of billion dollars being thrown into that technology, it's still as far from being commercially viable today as it was in the 1950s.
Same with solar, wind, and all the energy alternatives we've heard about this hour. Each has its own unique problems. They can probably be beaten, but they can't be ignored.
This equipment that's in front of us is a 20,000 horsepower motor.
As we mentioned earlier, coal gasification plants are monumentally expensive to build. The Dakota gasification plant went online in 1984. Immediately after, according to Daryl Hill, a spokesman for the company that owns the plant,
the price of natural gas dropped dramatically beyond all expectations.
The people who own the plant asked the government for price supports.
And the DOE said, no, we will not do that. And the consortium members said, this plant is yours.
The government ran the plant for a while before they sold it to Hill's company. The plant cost $2 billion to build. Hill says,
we bought it for $85 million.
The other problem, the North Dakota plant is near an oil field. So they have a place to put their CO2. But if you build a gasification plant that's not near an oil field, you're going to have to capture that CO2 and sequester it. According to MIT's Ernie Moniz, the scale of that capture and sequestration is massive.
If you take one utility-scale plant, that plant, with the CO2 captured for a 50-year lifetime, would require the sequestration of about 1 billion barrels of compressed CO2.
And that's just one gasification plant and one CO2 reservoir. If you built enough plants to make us energy independent, he says, you'd need thousands. Again, not insurmountable, but a tough problem. And we'll have to start addressing it now if we want to solve it. Or let's look at efficiency. Remember, Joan Ogden said about cars.
Right away, what we could do is to implement energy efficiency standards.
Specifically, corporate average fuel economy, or CAFE standards.
The UAW would be deeply concerned about the economic feasibility of any proposals to mandate significantly higher vehicle efficiency standards.
That's the president of the United Auto Workers, Ron Gettelfinger.
The imposition of stringent increases in vehicle efficiency standards could lead to calamitous results.
And he has company.
When the CAFE law was passed in the 1970s, the goal was to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. Frankly, that did not work.
That was the chairman of Ford, Alan Mulally. And here's the head of GM, Rick Wagner.
A 4% per year CAFE increase would be extraordinarily expensive and technologically challenging to implement.
Face it. We like to drive our big, fancy cars.
I have an SUV at home, and I'm going to drive it because I like it.
I love my car because it's a nice sports car, and you know, all the women love it, and I love it, so it can get me to A to B. So
remember Joan Ogden's challenge?
If we were willing to back off on the fast performance a little bit and on the weight a little bit, we could improve fuel economy quite markedly.
We could, but will we? That problem's not technological. It's personal. We can only solve it if we have the will.
Someday you're going to be using this in your cars.
Well, maybe. But just like the problem with efficiency, the principal roadblock to cellulosic ethanol also isn't technological. David Morris is with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. After Congress wrote the Energy Policy Act in 2005, he took a close look at the section dealing with cellulosic ethanol. Congress knew we couldn't rely on corn for all our ethanol, so the bill mandates that the U.S. produce 250 million gallons of ethanol from grass and weeds by 2013. But at the very last second, before the bill was passed, Morris says,
there was an alternative definition of cellulosic ethanol that was added.
Get this, the wording was changed so that you can qualify as producing cellulosic ethanol even if you never made a drop. They changed the law so that a factory making corn ethanol could qualify as cellulosic ethanol. The way they did it is complicated.
It defined the term cellulosic ethanol in a way that defies common sense.
It's based, believe it or not, on the way the refinery is heated. But the bill is now law, and this change, Morris says,
literally subverted the primary purpose of that entire section.
Corn ethanol is easy to make because there's so many people harvesting corn and delivering it to ethanol refineries. But cellulosic ethanol is new. There's practically no one out harvesting switchgrass. This law would have created incentives to build that infrastructure of people farming and harvesting cellulose. But as of right now, that's out. The law will have to be changed. Again, that will take political will. So what about hydrogen? Mike Ramage, impressed as he was with the H2Gen hydrogen generator, says,
I'm not an advocate of hydrogen.
The problem he sees, and others see it too, is not with hydrogen production, but with making a hydrogen car. According to Ford engineer Mujib Ijaz, all the popular alternative fuels have one thing in common. They need space on a vehicle.
The largest space of all of these fuels is for hydrogen.
And bulkiness is only part of it. Joan Ogden says there's also trouble with the guts of the fuel cell, those membranes that keep the wayward lovers, hydrogen and oxygen, apart from each other.
You have to make these things very good at conducting protons. You don't want losses. So part of it is getting a membrane that works well that way and also is a low-cost material.
Right now they use platinum. So much for low cost. Another problem is durability. As Mike Ramage says,
will it last 5,000 hours, which is pretty much how much driving time you expect out of an internal combustion engine?
At this point, no one is sure. You take all this together, and Ernie Moniz says,
hydrogen as an alternative transportation fuel is quite some ways away.
Instead, he says, we have to look somewhere else.
Plug-in hybrids are one example of such a technology.
Of course, there aren't any gallons because there's no gasoline. Ah, the beauty of it all.
So, remember a while back when I asked if you wanted to buy the Ford plug-in SUV? Well, that's going to be a little tough. Our producer found out why direct from the horse's mouth.
How many of these are there?
One.
And how much did it cost to build this?
The total, including people, was around $2 million.
Too steep? Well, there's always a Tesla.
This is the Tesla Roadster.
According to Forbes magazine, fully loaded, a Tesla Roadster will set you back $100,000. At the time that article was written, in March, 350 people had put down deposits. Another problem, and it's a big one. Most of these technologies, some would say none of these technologies can exist, let alone prosper, without significant help from the government. Jerry Taylor, the free marketer at the Libertarian Cato Institute, says,
it might very well be that absent government support, it doesn't make any sense to invest in this area. I mean, after all, if a technology has commercial promise, it doesn't need a dime of taxpayer help.
That's absolutely false. I mean, there isn't anything remotely true about that statement.
That's David Morris of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance.
It's just nonsense to think that, you know, that the marketplace somehow can bring these new technologies in all on its own. You know, the books are cooked when it comes to renewables versus non-renewables.
He says right now we just don't calculate the real cost of our gasoline. As Jack Huttner of Genencore says,
there are no such things as free markets in energy because of the impact of defending the sea lanes in the Middle East.
As H2Gen's Frank Lomax calculates it,
just 1 year of this war in Iraq would have paid for an entire hydrogen infrastructure and subsidized the production of the cars.
No one's talking about spending that kind of money. Mike Ramage says that's not the solution. Instead, he says, the government should put money into fundamental research, the kind that a company can't see itself making a profit off of in a short enough term.
The DOE can fund not only the national labs, but they can fund venture capital people, they can fund academics, and they can also even fund, maybe on a co-share basis, that goes into the larger companies. But there has to be a clear endpoint, and the subsidies, eventually the free market has to dictate.
In a recent State of the Union address, Roger Bezdek's company produced a study for the Southern States Energy Board where they looked at just what it would take to eliminate U.S. dependence on foreign oil by 2030.
You need, for example, 5 million barrels a day from coal to liquids. You need 3 million from oil shale. You need 4 million from biomass and so forth. Whether those are achievable technologically or financially or politically is another question.
That's sobering, but it's not hopeless. That's because Bezdek's calculation makes a common mistake. Mike Ramage says analysts who only look at the here and now
tend to look at technology in its current state and not to look at where technology might be. And being the R&D person that I am and always have been, I believe that you have to look at both.
There are breakthroughs out there. Ernie Moniz says big ones.
When you look at the surprises we are almost certainly going to continue seeing with new science and new technology, yes, I feel optimistic on the technology side.
Those surprises will come, he says, from scientists and engineers who can reimagine the way we make energy, doing it in ways we haven't even thought of yet. Ideas like this.
And what we do is all the carbon atoms in the coal is converted to carbon monoxide and not carbon dioxide. And then what we do
That's Purdue Chemical Engineering Professor Rakesh Agrawal. He's talking about an idea he's working on that would triple the amount of fuel we get from coal and from grass and garbage, and do it with no CO2.
So all that carbon dioxide sequestration, which people talk about, will disappear, basically.
As we said, the big changes will come from reimagining. In this case, reimagining today's coal gasification process, which Agrawal says is inefficient.
If there were 100 atoms, like 100 units of carbon in coal, you'll end up with only like 40 units as the final liquid fuel.
You get 40 units of fuel, and the other 60 go into the atmosphere as CO2. Same with crop waste.
Nearly one-third shows up as liquid fuel, okay? And two-thirds goes back to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide.
This new process, which he's published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, gets you triple the fuel. If you're working with coal, you start with hydrogen, which, remember, you can make from anything. So you make it from sunlight or wind.
And then we use that hydrogen and take every atom of carbon, which is in the coal, okay, and substitute the hydrogen on those carbon atoms, okay, and form the liquid fuel.
Working with crop waste, or as he calls it, biomass, you take hydrogen from the sun.
And then react that with biomass, okay, so that every carbon atom which comes in the biomass is converted to liquid fuel.
The efficiency and the carbon-free nature of the hydrogen makes this a win-win. More energy from the same amount of stuff and no CO2. When will we see this?
In the next 5 to 10 years, we should be able to, like, you know, start building the prototype plants, actually.
This solution, like others we've heard about, it will come, though maybe slower than we wish. This isn't a quick fix, one of those miracles you hear about on the evening news and then you never see. And according to Professor Jay Gore, that's okay. It's important, in fact, not to look for the quick fix. Becoming energy independent is a problem that's going to take a lot longer than the quarterly cycles that Wall Street and our political system usually work with. And Gore says there are not just technology problems either.
It is social, political, economic challenge, and social, political, and economic preparations are going to be as necessary as science and technology preparations.
Gore says to get there, we must have
a systematic plan that tells us how we are going to navigate from now till the future where we have multiple sources of energy to rely on.
And will we get there? And will we get there in time?
I am very confident that we will, as human beings, we will find a solution.
America has always responded well to a crisis. But thinking about peak oil, considering the magnitude, the devastation it could cause to our lives and our lifestyles, considering all of that, the question becomes, can we act before the crisis to protect everything we take for granted today and keep it going in a world after oil? We have the tools, but do we have the will? Do we have the determination? Do we have the energy? After Oil was written and produced by Richard Paul. It was edited by Richard Miles. Our remote engineers were Walter Dixon, Steve Sargent, Marla Schmidt, Kenton McDonald, Joey Jones, Philip Greitzer, and Brad Linder. The interview with Michael Pollan is courtesy of Fresh Air with Terry Gross, produced in Philadelphia by WHYY and distributed by National Public Radio. Archival footage came from the Prelinger Archive, part of the Internet Archive at archive.org. This program has been a production of the Purdue University College of Engineering and the Energy Center at Purdue's Discovery Park. Discovery Park is Purdue University's hub for interdisciplinary research, pursuing solutions to the grand challenges of our time. On the web at discoverypark.purdue.edu. I'm Barbara Bogave.
Looking for something to do this 4th of July? But the thought of traveling and exposing yourself to swine flu is more than you can take? Then join the Capital Steps for their 4th of July edition of Politics Takes a Holiday. It's the only show that promises to be funnier than a press conference by Joe Biden. Here are the details.
Don't miss it. Friday, July 3rd at 2:30 in the afternoon and again at 6:30 in the evening. WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
The following program.